that there are other people who are your coworkers who had the same positive experience from this.
Yes, yes. I've known quite a number of people in the organization there who have had the same kind of experience to a greater or lesser extent, and have also found it highly rewarding and certainly conducive to professional growth.
This is, it seems like an extremely liberal attitude that the company had, and kind of very open-minded approach. I mean, it sounds like it was a good approach and a good way to do things. It's just that it doesn't have or wouldn't have what you would call a concrete or a real specific hard payoff for the company. It would be a more of a very much soft payoff in terms of interactions and networking and that kind of thing. Obviously industrial organizations do have a focus on making money. I find it kind of interesting that they would support this type of a thing, which cost them some money over such a long period of time, and continue to support it and through, I guess, thick and thin. Obviously, there were good years and bad years for Amoco. So,
well, I think what we're talking about here is closely akin to the questions that from time to time came up in connection with the kind of work that I was doing. When I've had to answer the question of why I did what I was, why I was doing what I was doing, and how is it going to help the company make a buck? You know, how is what I'm doing today going to help the company make a buck tomorrow,
right,
perhaps? Some of my answers there also tied in with this kind of consideration. I came to know personally a great many people in industry, in academia, and in government laboratories in this country and abroad who were darn good. And there have been times, a number of times over the years, when I had some problem that I was struggling with. It might have been in my own exploratory work, or it might have been in connection with some very practical, down-to-earth applied problem that I wasn't quite sure how to cope with, but where I could make a pretty good guess of who was likely to be able to help me, and I could get on the phone and call somebody anywhere, wherever he might be, and reach him and get the benefit of that kind of acquaintanceship. In addition, the personal relationships that grew up there paid off in connection with recruiting in many ways. Mm-hmm. For example, at McGill University and at the National Research Council in Ottawa, in both of those places, I had quite a number of very good friends in both of them. And they were awfully helpful to me. They first, when I made a visit to either of these, they helped make the visit very pleasant. At the National Research Council, every time that I was up there, Fred Lossing would always have a bunch of people out to his house to a party for me every time. At McGill, one evening during the 2 or 3 day stay that I had there, I always took George Just and Jack Edwards and their wives out to dinner. And the other evenings I would be a dinner guest in their homes. But in addition to that, they were more than helpful in helping me size up candidates. I can recall vividly either George Just or Jack Edward asking to see the list of their doctoral candidates who had signed up for me to interview, and telling me that guy's a deadbeat, forget about him. Telling me that, now, you know, I got a student here whom I don't find that ought to be here. He's one of the best we've had in years. And he chased down to the student's laboratory and chased him up to see me, mm-hmm. even though he had not signed up in advance mm-hmm. for an interview. In one instance, we had a candidate who had come in cold. The guy had had approached the company. He was working in an academic institution in Chicago, and apparently there was somebody high in our management levels who was an old family friend of his, and he worked through this guy, and the request came in such a way that people in research really didn't feel they had any choice. We had to essentially drop everything mm-hmm. and schedule an interview with this fellow fast. Mm-hmm. That interview took place on a day when I happened to be off sick or something. I wasn't there. The fellow made a remarkably good impression on almost everybody he talked to. And it was clear when I got back, you know, that they were talking about making him an offer. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, the fellow had been on the staff of the chemistry department at the University of Houston some years earlier, and had left there, gone somewhere else, and then ultimately to some school in Chicago. But at the time, I was scheduled to pay a visit to University of Houston and to talk before a seminar there, where my host and longtime friend was Jerry Meisels. And so the way we left it was that I would question Jerry about this fellow when I was down there, and our management would not do anything about following up the interview with this fellow until I got back. When I mentioned this guy's name to Jerry, first he said, excuse me, he went and closed the door to his office, and then he came back and told me the story, and there was a long, terrible history. So that during the time that this guy had been there, he had all but wrecked the department. He had done so much damage to students, to support staff. He had alienated almost everybody on the professional staff of the department. He had, after he had been given his notice and he had maybe 2 years in which to find a job elsewhere, he had, without authorization, spent huge amounts of departmental money. It was a very bad experience. He'd had one or two graduate students in the mill at the time that he left. They were left hanging. One of them, there was no way that anything could be salvaged of this guy's research.
So the guy had the credentials and he interviewed well, but basically you didn't want him.
That's right. And when I brought back that report, believe me, it played a large role in the ultimate decision. So things of this kind are, it's hard to put a dollar value on them. But they make a difference,
yeah.
and the kind of professional reputation and professional contacts that I had built up were valuable to the company in many such situations.
Earlier in the very beginning, you talked about the fact that there was this dichotomy that some people thought between doing the applied work and doing research work. During your career in the 50s, where you were doing a lot of fundamental things, did you have to deal with applied problems as well, or problems more mundane?
Always.
Okay.
Always.
What kinds of things were you doing in this environment, yes. this year of research?
Well, after we moved into the new laboratories in 48, very gradually, I worked my way more and more into qualitative analysis and molecular structure work, in large part by virtue of the conceptual connections, let's say, with the exploratory things that I was doing. Ultimately, after we moved into the new location in Naperville, that was in 1970, from that time on, well, I was assured by my division director, not too long after we moved in there, that the kinds of challenges, questioning of my activities that had used to happen at high management levels years before had not happened for a long time, and I could be confident that they would never happen again, that the management hierarchy all the way up and down the line understood by then that a great deal of the kinds of things that I was doing to assist people with their own programs of various kinds, I was able to do because I'd been doing my homework for the previous 25 years. And they were confident that there would never again be any questioning. Now, by the time we'd gotten to Naperville, we were a much larger, our mass spectrometry laboratory was a much larger one. And at various times we had 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 instruments, several technical people in the department, quite a number of support staff, and a division of labor that was unavoidable, so that the quantitative analysis that we continued to do, the qualitative analysis, more or less, that was at a simpler level, and a lot of the other things, type analysis, these were chiefly in the hands of other people, and a large part of the calculations and interpretations were computerized by that time. I found myself on the receiving end only of problems that people had already tried to attack by other easier and faster and cheaper means and had not been able to cope with effectively, so that I was frequently working with molecular structure problems, sometimes relatively simple, sometimes very complex. I can think of one case in which the material that came to me was an additive that our company had been purchasing from some other firm and putting into some of the products. And the vendor was not willing to reveal the chemical composition.
Surprise.
Now, my problem was to define the chemical composition, and while I was at it, I found that from the impurities, the contaminants that were mixed in with it, I could state with a great deal of confidence what the entire synthetic procedure had been that the supplier had used to make the compound. Now this is kind of an extra dividend, but it was not uncommon to find things of that kind. A good many of my problems had to do with additives, both in petroleum products and in polymers. And there was a whole category of additives that were used in polymers that are put there in order to minimize or eliminate color development in the product. In one whole category of problem situations that came to me over a period of quite a number of years, in which our product, our polymer, had been used to make a commercial product, and after the consumer product had been manufactured and had sat on the shelves of in a warehouse somewhere, that surfaces that had been treated with a white pigment were turning yellow, and people were unhappy about that. And what I established there was that the additive that was supposed to prevent color formation was the source of the yellow color, and that it was photosensitive, and if you got it out in the sunlight long enough, the color would go away again. But then you stored it somewhere away from the sunlight, and the color would come back again.
So it was good at preventing the development of coloring in a bright environment.
And it was not too hard, really, to find some other additive that could perform the function just as well and would not produce the color. Furthermore, after we had been through that the first time, over a period of several years, the same problem developed again and again and kept coming back to me. In each case, I had to do enough work to confirm that it was actually the same problem. It was.
When I talked to O.P. Tanner, it was also in an industrial environment. We did address the issue of a kind of a dollar payoff in mass spectrometry. A lot of the time, the instrument can be used to find out information along the lines that you were discussing here. In OP's case, there was a very costly plant operation that was being developed along certain lines, and given the mass spec data, they were able to change the development along lines that ended up making it successful, rather than if they had gone along the original plan, then it would have been, the plant production would not have, it wouldn't have performed as it had desired. So clearly in that case, the cost of the instrument was a small fraction of the money it saved the company in a real world situation. Can you think of any similar incident that had that kind of a big kick payoff for your organization?
It's a little hard to answer that question adequately because it's such a long time since I dealt with the kinds of problems mm-hmm. that were involved there. I do remember some years ago when one of the in-house publications of Amoco carried a story about the development years previous of trying to remember what the process was, and I can't even think of the proper name of it right now, but in any case, it's a major petroleum refining procedure in which credit was extended to the people who had played a role in all sorts of different ways to make that process feasible. I think this was platforming.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall anything specific that I did there except to do perfectly what were then perfectly routine gas analyses of samples coming from the plant during that time.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody evidently felt that the kind of analytical support that I was able to furnish merited my being listed among the people who played mm-hmm. crucial roles in the development of the process. This kind of thing has happened on a few occasions at least. Now, that's not a very specific kind of answer, but it's the best I can do
at
the moment.
Well, I think it is germane, or it addresses the issue. Frequently, particularly as this equipment becomes more expensive, it seems that it's harder to justify in a lot of industrial or in any environment, and I see that after the fact, it seems in many organizations, once a piece of equipment is purchased, then there's a lot of assumptions made that basically it's doing whatever it was that it was bought for, and management seems to ignore it or forget it, which I guess in many cases is good and perhaps in others isn't. But I mean, in other words, frequently no one ever bothers to find out, well, you know, Meyerson told us if we bought this piece of equipment then we'd be able to handle these problems, and so they buy it, but nobody ever comes around to find out, you know, to kind of check up and see whether or not they were, you know, that was successfully done. And
well, perhaps a kind of indirect answer to the question might help. Mm-hmm. Over all the years that I worked for the company, I do not recall any time that I or Henry Grubb or anybody else working with me there in the mass spec group had to go to our management and sell them an instrument that we wanted to buy. The question we had to answer was we had to let them know that we wanted something and give them some notion of what it was for, and beyond that, essentially, we were left with our management was convinced very easily every time that the investment was going to pay off, and the most vivid recollections I have in connection with the purchase of new equipment are that when I was having trouble and taking more time than had been anticipated to decide precisely what equipment I wanted, I found myself being needled to get on the ball and let us know what you want us to buy.
Yeah.
This happened repeatedly over all through the years that I was with the company. So, I felt that that whoever the individuals may have been, there were people in our management who had to make decisions of this kind, who had developed and who continue to maintain over the years a lot of confidence of our whole mass spec team, so that they did not give us a hard time. They really just wanted the benefit of our best thinking about what equipment we ought to have, and that would be useful.
Was that a fairly short turnaround time? I mean, would a year be sufficient to recommend the purchase of a piece of equipment and then to have it, or at least issue a purchase order? Or?
Well, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Okay.
But that's a pretty good ballpark estimate. But often, once management had agreed, you know, that this sort of instrument was to be acquired and they put it in the capital budget, they really would have liked us to move as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself trying to hold them off.
In order to get a good assessment of what the vendors had to offer at that time and which would be the best piece of equipment for your particular applications, is that why you would kind of want to hold them off a little bit?
Yes, it's varied.
Yeah.
And there certainly were times when we wanted samples of the analytical, we submitted samples for measurement to two or three or four manufacturers, and there were times and we wanted to get results, and sometimes it took a long time to get those results.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when we had a pretty good notion of what equipment we wanted, but we were not satisfied with it as it stood, and we insisted that the manufacturer needed to do some modifications, some further development, and that took time, so that it varied from one situation to another. I know we took a long time, for example, to get before we got high resolution. We didn't buy our first high resolution instrument until 1966, I think it was. And certainly there were a number of laboratories that had it earlier than we did. And we had spent a lot of time and effort,
mm-hmm,
before reaching that decision.
The did there are obviously a number of vendors who are in the mass business of providing instrumentation. Would you care to comment on promises and delivery? Frequently, vendors are pretty liberal about what they say their equipment can do, and then not so infrequently, when it's on the floor, it's not so easy to meet some of those specifications. Do you have any anecdotes or stories that you'd like to share with us about those events, or perhaps a piece of equipment that really turned out to be maybe a lemon?
By and large, all through the years, all the time that the CBC instruments were being made and marketed, by and large, our experience then was pretty doggone good. Mm-hmm. There were at least one or two people that they had in the field that we tried very hard to avoid. There were certainly times when we felt very much more comfortable doing our own maintenance work than having the vendor do the maintenance work, partly because we didn't trust the field people whom they had out in our area at that mm-hmm. time. We would prefer they keep their hands off our machines. I recall about the time, very early in the game, about the time that we moved out of the original laboratory in the refinery to New York Avenue, that for the new machine that we bought there at New York Avenue, we turned down the offer of a service contract. On the other hand, when we did most of our own servicing, occasionally we had to call in somebody from the vendor. But at that time, I remember that Grace Marsh, who remained with the machine in the Tech Service Laboratory, responsible for its operation, did decide to buy the service contract. And for some years, that service contract included, I think, one or two regularly scheduled visits a year for preventive maintenance, aside from anything else. And I recall vividly that every time there was a call for preventive maintenance, they shut the thing down, the field man did whatever he was going to do on it, they tried to start up again, and they were on the blink. This happened constantly. It got to be a real long time standing joke. And the moral of the story, which is an old moral to anybody working with equipment, is if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
You shut down the equipment and you change the temperatures of parts throughout the circuitry, and something is thrown out of kilter, and you may be down for a couple of weeks. This just happened repeatedly. I recall also one instance in which, this must again go back to somewhere in the ballpark of 1948 or thereabouts, when we were having trouble with the analog computer that we bought from Consolidated. Now, you know, the guts of this computer consisted of a great big drum with 12 rows of 12 helipots each. So that's 144 potentiometers in a network. And if any one of those pots was thrown off, it affected all the other 143. They were not operating, they did not operate independently of each other. And so realigning things got to be a very hairy experience. Well, we developed a whole slew of rules of thumb for coping with it, and for the most part, we managed pretty well. But on at least one occasion, we got into a terrible bind, and we just didn't know where to start anymore. We wrote a letter to Consolidated describing the symptoms and asking them for advice. And we got back a letter with a lot of long words and a lot of what we interpreted as pure double talk that said, in effect, if the thing is out of alignment, you just have to start working at it and realign it. And one of my co-workers wrote a little note on the side of the, in the margin of the letter, very sage advice. So this kind of thing happened. The time came when we were in the market for other instruments, and we were checking out other manufacturers, and when we made a firm decision to go the way of VG rather than Kratos for some of our newer equipment. At present, I think we have both Kratos and VG equipment. I shouldn't say we. My successors, my the other folks, the folks who are still in the laboratory, have both. But we visited a great many laboratories. We talked to people, got the benefits of their experience with these firms, and VG, as nearly as we could size up, seemed to be very much more responsive to their users' problems and needs than Kratos, at least at that time. And I don't think that we ever regretted that choice.
You mentioned purchasing a high-resolution instrument at that time. Obviously, the choice would have been between electrical detection and photoplate detection as one of the things you had to deal with. How did that come out when you essentially addressed that issue? How did you end up?
Well, we got a CEC 21110, which offered us both photographic and electrical detection. We were not able to clearly rule out a need for photographic detection at the time we were trying to size up what was available and how we were going to use it. We made a moderate amount of use of it over the years, not as much as we thought we might, but we felt that, now Chuck Robinson and I shared in that decision, and we were both convinced that there was an advantage to having both available.
Okay, because that there's always been an issue, or at least there was an issue for a long time, which would be preferable. And really, I suppose, in a way, the fact that with at least the 110, you could have both detection schemes that gave you a little more flexibility. Earlier, when we had a little discussion after lunch, you'd mentioned that the company made names of employees available to local schools, universities, as speakers. I'd like to just kind of go over that material again. What was the company's interest or purpose in this type of a thing?
Well, our management was pretty well convinced that even if for nothing else, purely for recruiting purposes, there was a great deal to be gained by our people knowing personally and having good personal and professional relationships with academic people. The company was very careful to separate visits to give seminars from any recruiting visits. Within this country, they never combined them. Our visits to give seminars and to just become acquainted with the departments were attempts, were set up entirely independently, and generally there was no talk at all about recruiting during that time. We felt that if we and the academic people and departments know and respect each other, then whether it's recruiting or other things, that there will be occasions when we can call on each other and trust each other. In addition, there were many times when spending a day in a department and talking to maybe a dozen people in a department during the day, when I would learn enough about what the kinds of research that people were doing there, so that I could bring back some suggestions or ideas that could be helpful to other people in our organization as well. Mm-hmm. So that there were advantages, all kinds of advantages. Now, in addition, there were time. Now, our company has, for many, many years, contributed through its foundation, through the Amoco Foundation, made financial contributions for the support of academic institutions, and particularly for chemistry and chemical engineering departments. It has funded fellowships, and there have been a number of occasions when, in the course of a visit to an academic department, we would learn of some specific kind of need or problem within the department, as a result of which our company might make a gift or some piece of equipment to the department, so that we help each other in various ways. There were times when, personal contacts that were built up during these visits led to an expression on the part of academic people of their interest in spending the summer working in our laboratories, and where that was worked out, and they came and spent a summer working with us.
So basically, it sounds like the company had decided at a fairly high level to be a good scientific citizen.
Oh, yes.
And pursued that very really, and not just in as a facade or with window dressing. They really were interested in being a good scientific citizen and interacting with the academic community and
absolutely
becoming a part of the larger.
Absolutely. I think that my visits to McGill, University of Montreal, and National Research Council in Canada were the only instances in which we combined seminars, personal visits of that kind with recruiting. And that was kind of a historical accident, because the contacts with these institutions occurred first when I was invited to speak before seminar groups up there. And I found myself sufficiently impressed by a lot of the people up there that I urged our company to institute recruiting, to extend our recruiting activities to them. And so for a number of years, we did that, but I handled both and combined the two in a single visit. I might spend 3 days in Montreal and 2 or 3 days in Ottawa. Now, after the first several years, I found that the number of people who signed up for interviews was large enough that it would have been just hard for me to cope with them all. Mm-hmm. And Ellis Fields started to go along with me on those visits, and we would divide up the interviews. Then somewhere along the line, I dropped out of that entirely, and Ellis continued for a number of years, so that we maintained the contact and the pattern of relationship with those companies. I don't mean companies, with those institutions.
Okay.
I can recall, incidentally, a fascinating situation. The first time that Ellis made that trip with me, at the National Research Council, there was an explicit ground rule that they would not accept any professional interviewers who were not themselves technical people. And furthermore, if they were technical people who had moved into administration, they were not acceptable. They needed to be technical people involved in technical work. Now, we were in perfectly good position there, because all the professional interviewing for our research and development was done by technical people doing technical work, mm-hmm. wherever they went. Mm-hmm. And there was never any question. But the first year that Ellis made that trip with me, he was not well acquainted up there. People didn't know what to expect of him. He was asked explicitly what his background and work consist of, and he spelled it out. And even so, some of the people that we went around to talk to were a little suspicious. I remember Ellis is telling me one instance where, after we had interviewed the postdoctorals finishing up their work up there, we were both individually making the rounds of staff people under whose supervision these postdoctorals were working to talk to them about the interviewees. And there was one laboratory that Ellis walked into where the chemist whose laboratory it was had been discussing some organic chemical problem with his postdoctorals, and they had the blackboard covered mm-hmm. with chemical symbols. And when Ellis came in, the fellow immediately called him over and asked him, "What do you think about this chemistry?" And Ellis said there wasn't a moment's question in his mind. This fellow was testing him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the school was so particular about...
This is not a school, you know, this is a National Research
okay.
Council.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Their training is all at postdoctoral level. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good policy for all institutions mm-hmm. where they train people for professional work.
That they should be hired by people who are doing the technical work.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is a terribly tough task trying to size up people in a short while with a half hour or 45 minute or hours interview under the best of circumstances. Mm-hmm. These interviews always left me terribly uneasy. I always leaned heavily on the subsequent information that I got by talking to the staff people under whom these candidates had been doing their work.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these, of course, were people whom I'd come to know well over the years and whom I trusted. And even then, there were many times when I brought back recommendations to our laboratory that we should or should not invite this candidate to come to Whiting or to mm-hmm. for an interview. When I made that recommendation with a great many misgivings,
mm-hmm.
I felt very unsure. I mean, you know, what comes out of one of those interviews can make a world of difference in the entire life of the individual and can make an enormous difference to the organization
mm-hmm.
that's considering hiring him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that much confidence in my ability to size people up in short order.
Yeah.
After I've known them for several years and I've had a lot of dealings with them, it's another matter.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. But I'm confident that the ground rule under which the National Research Council there operates is eminently sensible,
mm-hmm.
and while it doesn't solve the problem, it at least helps.
Yeah, it addresses the issue and then tries to keep it from getting worse than it is, or, you know, the problem from being even worse. When we had a little walk after lunch, you'd mentioned that in the laboratory there had been a particularly depressing period when there were some layoffs, and I'd like to just kind of review some of the things that you talked about then, the idea that you had been kind of, although you were still employed after this initial layoff period, that you had kind of been counseled by people who respected you that perhaps it would be good to look around.
Yes. This was in 1961. The company had cut back costs, expenses throughout the entire organization, all aspects of work, and R&D was no exception. One Friday afternoon, the entire professional staff, R&D there in Whiting, was called into one big meeting, and we were given the word of what was happening. About 12 or 15% of the professional staff was being laid off. Great many research areas that have been part of our program for years were being simply eliminated. It was the start of a long period of great depression around the organization. Many people who had not been laid off decided that this was not the kind of thing they wanted to live with, and they left of their own free will, went elsewhere. Nobody around the place could avoid thinking in terms of possibly making a change during that time. It was somewhere during that period that Tucker, who was now my division director, called me into his office and offered a bit of fatherly advice to me. He expressed his great discouragement. He could see no hope that things were going to get better there in our organization. He pointed out to me that I had built a good professional reputation, that I should have no difficulty in breaking into the academic world, and he urged me to do that.
Mm-hmm. You had about, 15 years experience then, 46 to 61?
Yeah. It may have been 62 or 63, but it was in that time frame. He also reminded me that if I did decide to follow his recommendation, that he would further advise me not to agree to anything without having a very clear and firm understanding first as to how I was going to get that union card, the doctorate. And he pointed out that while there in our laboratory, as in many industrial laboratories, that the doctorate may play a large part in determining the starting salary of an individual, after a few years, it really doesn't make too much difference anymore, that what one has done on the job is far more important than what degree one may have brought before coming. But that in the academic world, it doesn't work that way. And he urged me strongly, and as I mentioned to you also while we were talking, over a few year period there, on a number of occasions, I was approached by academic institutions with offers, and in particular, I remember vividly the first such offer that came from a fine, large chemistry department in a major state university. It was an offer of a full professorship with tenure, and the man who approached me on behalf of the department, whom I had come to know pretty well for some years by that time, told me without my raising the question that when the department chairman asked him to talk to me, he had reminded the chairman that I did not have that higher degree, and he wanted to be sure that it was clearly understood so there'd be no embarrassment later. And the chairman's response was he was well aware of it, but he was confident that we could work out a program so that if I did come, I could be confident of getting that an earned doctorate within about a year. Now, maybe it would have worked out, maybe it wouldn't have, but and that I found that offer very flattering. I appreciated it a great deal, as I did other offers from other institutions later, but in each case I ultimately decided to stay put, that even though things were bad in many respects there at our laboratory, the atmosphere was very gloomy much of the time, it seemed to me that the half dozen or dozen people in the organization whom I regarded as outstanding professional people were still there. I felt that as long as that nucleus was still there, there was hope. And if you make a change, no matter what the circumstances may be, there is also a large gamble. Mm-hmm. There's always, inevitably, a large gamble involved. And I decided to stay put. That decision